Forward Guidance is brought to you by VanEck, a global leader in asset management since 1955. You'll be hearing more about VanEck ETFs later on, but for now, let's get into today's interview. Very happy to welcome back to Forward Guidance for his third appearance, Milton Berg of MB Advisors. Milton is a technical analyst who spends a lot of time focusing on turning points, so a lot more focus on the data rather than, you know, drawing lines on charts. In his first appearance, a little under a year ago, Milton was exceptionally bullish on the stock market at a time when most people, including myself, were very bearish. That call aged well. On his second appearance in late August, early September of last year, he was still 100% long, but he was getting a little bit anxious as some of his buy signals were fading. I'm very glad to talk to Milton again and to see what he's been viewing the market. So Milton, it's wonderful to have you back. My first question is, what are your views on the market right now?
Thank you, Jack. Nice being here. I enjoy your interviews. You do a great job. And I really, I learned from the interview as well, because you ask good questions, makes me think a little bit. But no, I was not. I actually was short last July when we spoke. When we spoke, I was still 110 long, but I actually did go short. The S&P did decline some 10.38% from its July peak, July 31st peak, to its October 27th low. And we were short during that period. We got aggressively long the day after the low, after October 27th low. We'll discuss that in this interview, hopefully. And my current view, though, we got a number of buy signals a year ago when we were first on. We were very bullish in the market. The projections we gave at that time have all been met. For example, we had a number of buy signals in January of 2023. The NASDAQ, as you know, bottomed in December of 2022. And the S&P 500 bottomed in October of 2022. And in January 2023, we had roughly 15 individual buy signals. And they projected to a median gain of to 4,956.23 in the S&P. So you just met that objective this year, in this January. We got above 4,956.23. So once we have buy signals that worked and they met their objective, we have to start worrying. Will it go above the objective? When I say it's the objective, this is the median projection of all those 15 signals or so. It could go above the median. It could go to the maximum projection, but we never talk about maximums. You don't expect maximums. You expect medians. So we got the median. An example of what we saw a year ago, for example, on January 12th of 2023, which was just less than 2 weeks past the low in the NASDAQ, the New York Stock Exchange 10-day advance of 10-day declines gave what's called a breadth thrust. It's a very famous technical tool. I was the only one who discovered it, of 1.90 to 1. And that projected a 5,035.98 in the S&P 500, which also retained that just now. Another signal we got on January 25th, for example, of 2023 was the S&P 600 gained in price for 4 weeks in a row, which is a bullish momentum momentum figure. And the S&P 500 upside downside volume was greater than 19 to 1 in 2 out of the previous 10 days. And that, when you combine those two momentum indicators, we got a projection of 5,067.83. which I believe we hit as well, 5,060. We got to 5,111. So these indicators a year ago met their objectives. So when you meet the objectives, I'd say to myself, I can no longer be bullish based on those signals. Those signals met their objectives. And that's going back last year to January. However, at the lows in October, we got a number of new buy signals. Now, these new buy signals give us greater projections. So the question is, how much weight do we put in buy signals that came that took place during a bull market rather than at the end of a bear market? What I mean to say is that in October of 2023 was a very strange market, because the Russell 2000 made its bear market low on October 27, 2023. The S&P made its bear market low a year earlier, October 2022. Russell 2000 and the banking index, for example, made their bear market lows on a closing basis in October of 2023. But we got buy signals off those lows as well. For example, the October buy signals project to 4,995.84.
We're above that.
We're above that as well. So although we got new buy signals in October, we're above those buy signals. And these are the median projections. But in November, we got more than 30 separate buy signals in November of 2023. And the median projection for the November signals is, can hold on to your seat, is 5,580.75. We haven't reached that at all. But we did reach the minimum projection. In other words, every signal For example, we have a signal. I'll give you one example. We have a signal which was generated on November 3rd, which the S&P 500, the number of issues trading above the 10-day average was 90%. So 90% of the 500 stocks are trading above the 10-day average. And at the same time, the S&P mid-caps generated the greatest five-day rate of change in more than a quarter of a year. And the S&P 600, which is the S&P small cap, generated a five-day rate of change of greater than 7%. There are three separate independent momentum indicators. When you combine them together, we got 10 historical instances. So you look at the median of those 10 instances, would project to 5,461, which would be the median of those instances. The minimum of those instances project to 4,861. When looking at all 30 signals we got, we've met the minimum projection of 5,002.23. We haven't met the median projection of 5,580. So now I have to tell myself, October of 2023, was that the beginning of a new bull move and I can expect hit the median? Or that was just an extending signal within a bull market? So if you look at the Russell, tell yourself, well, this is a new bull market because the Russell just made a bear market low. It wasn't within an extended bull move in the Russell. The Russell made a new low. On the other hand, the S&P 500 and the Nasdaq made their lows almost S&P was a year earlier, and the Nasdaq was on an intraday basis also a year earlier. On a closing basis, its closing low was December 2023.
All right, so Milton, you've got a series of new buy signals in October and November, but I think I heard you say at the beginning that you are bearish and outright short, which you haven't been so far on this program in your two appearances. The obvious question, Milton, is if you've got all these buy signals, why are you short? Do you have sell signals? Do you think your buy signals are wrong for some reason? Why are you short? Why are you bearish?
So there's really two ways to look at this. I was just trying to point out that the buy signals we've got in November, the projection was 5,002. So you ask, why are you short when you have buy signals? Well, I'll say, well, we met the minimum objective. The buy signals we got in December of 2023 project to a minimum of 4,970, although the maximum, the medium is 5,621. So you can't, I can argue that, you know, based on these signals, they're not really by going short, I'm not violating these signals, number one, because maybe all we'll meet is the minimum objective rather than the medium objective. But number two is, I could be short, or we may just get a correction within a bull market. Maybe we'll go down 10, 12, 15% within a bull market and continue higher. In that case, it makes sense to be short. But the reasons we're short are based on technical indicators we have to get to in a moment. I just wanted to point out, though, for your viewers, that the we're not necessarily saying there is a bear market ahead. We just think it's quite possible there's a bear market ahead. We'll get to that in a moment. But I just would like to point out that there was quite a number of buy signals that were generated both in October, November, and December. We have met the minimum objectives of the balance of the majority of those buy signals, but we certainly have not yet met the medium projection. Now, I still want to stick to the bullish side for a moment before I get to the bearish side, because there's really I think it's quite important to point out this tremendous momentum we had in this market. It's not a simple bull market. The action off the October low, in fact, is very, very unique in some sense. It's unique in fact, in the strength you've seen. It's also unique in a way in the weakness you've seen. When you look at the unweighted indices, when you look at the Russell 2000, you look at the small cap indices and so on and so forth. And I like to get to these things one at a time. So for example, the latest buy signal we got, at least in December, on December 29th, the S&P 500 was up for 9 weeks in a row. At the same time, the Nasdaq was up 9 weeks in a row. This does not happen very, very often. Not only that, we were up 9 weeks in a row. We had gained 15.85% over those 9 weeks. The S&P 500 gained 15.85%. Never in history, when both the Nasdaq and the S&P 500 both gained 9%, did the S&P gain as much as 15.85%. In 2012 was 11.7%, in 2010 was 12%, in 2010 was 13%, in 1985 was 12% and 11%. But the point being is that in most of these instances, it took place during a bull market. The only one time when the S&P 500 and the Nasdaq both generated gains for 9 weeks in a row, the only one time which the market went down was on April 12, 2010, which is right before the flash crash decline. The market actually peaked 9 days later on April 23rd, only 1.738% higher, and it declined 14.5% from the time from that date that you had both the Nasdaq and the S&P 500 up 9 weeks in a row. So this is not, I'm just pointing out there's a lot of momentum to this market. And even the fact that, that both these indices are up 9 weeks in a row, although historically in most instances it's a bull market, the market continues higher, there was one instance where it generated a top 9 days later and the market declined 14%. But in our case, you really can't compare it to the case where we're top 9 days later, because we're currently 37 days later, we've gained 6.6%. We haven't topped immediately. Momentum is continuing.
Everything's great. Why are you bearish?
Why am I bearish? Right. So we're going to have to get to why I'm bearish. But you have to point out that this market has been giving a tremendous number of buy signals. Let's get to the bearish case. If you'd like to get to the bearish case immediately, I'd rather really talk about the bullish case. Number one is...
Okay. So we'll promise our viewers we'll get to the bearish case, but for the order of your presentation, yeah, let's keep on talking about bullish indicators.
We want to talk about the bullish case because say you get a 10% to 12% correction and then the market blows off to, 6,000 in the S&P. That would have been projected by the signals we saw in December and in January, December and November and so on. However, we did see indications right now in January and February to suggest a top and maybe a final top. Maybe not a final top, maybe a corrective top. In any event, it's enough for me to be short. We'll get to that in a moment. Let's talk about the S&P 500. The S&P 500 has gained 235% in 24 years since its peak on September 1st, 2000. September 1st, 2000, the S&P made a peak just 0.5% below its peak in March of 2000. So for technical purposes, I look at the peak of the S&P 500 in 2000, not in March when the NASDAQ made its final peak, but in September when the S&P and the New York Stock Exchange actually made its final closing high. So the S&P is up 235% in 24 years. On the other hand, it's also up 666% since its low of March 6, 2009. An interesting thing is people assume the S&P makes 10% per annum. You say buy stocks, buy the index, you learn 10% per annum. It's not really true. It's only if you bought stocks at average prices. If you buy stocks after a bear market, at the lows, you'll make far more than 10% per annum. If you buy stocks at the highs, like at the high of 2000, you'll make far less than 10% per annum. So the reality is someone who buys stocks at average prices, on average, will return 10% per annum. But if somebody buys stocks above average prices, he will not make 10% per annum in the S&P 500. The point being, it seems we're in a bull market. Why? Because we just made a new high. April 23rd, 2024, the S&P is at 5,111.06 on an intraday basis. It's a new all-time high. It seems we're in a bull market. You'd think so. However, you really have to put on a different set of glasses and look at the market differently. Because there's something called inflation. Mm-hmm. Now, people weren't so aware of inflation for the last decade or the last 15 years or so. But inflation in the United States, there's always some inflation. And sometimes it's strong inflation. Sometimes it's weak inflation. But basically, we've generally been in an inflationary period. On an inflation-adjusted basis, the S&P 500 did not make a new high on February 23rd, 2024. The S&P made its high on January 4th, 2022. The S&P on an inflation-adjusted basis is not at a new high. And in fact, the S&P has a historical situation of generating many long bull markets on an inflationary basis, inflation-adjusted basis, and many long bear markets on an inflation-adjusted basis. For example, from the S&P made an all-time high in 1966 on a non-inflationary adjusted basis, made another all-time high in 1974, and it made another all-time high in 1986, 1985. But on an inflation-adjusted basis, the S&P peaked in 1966. And the bear market lasted until 1985, until 1982. In other words, the S&P bear market began in it peaked in 1966 on an inflation-adjusted basis, but it continued lower and lower and lower on an inflation-adjusted basis until 1982, although you saw higher prices in 1974 and 1980 and so on. So I'm thinking that currently what you saw at the peak in 2002, at January 3, 2002, maybe on an inflation-adjusted basis, maybe a peak that lasts quite a while. Let's not fool ourselves in thinking that just because the S&P and the NDX are at new closing highs above that level, that is true on a non-inflation-adjusted basis, but on an inflation-adjusted basis, it's quite possible that they will remain the peak of the bull market that began in 2009, and March 6, 2009, on an inflation-adjusted basis, made its peak on January 3rd, 2022 in the S&P, maybe roughly like November 8th and November 12th, 2021 in the NASDAQ. And that might be the ultimate bull market peak, which would not exceed for quite a number of years. Very important point to point out. We have to look at the stocks on an inflation-adjusted basis. This is just putting sort of a pouring cold water on the idea that we're at new highs. We're not really at new highs. First of all, as we know, the Russell 2000 is not at a new high. And we know that the unweighted S&P 500 is not at a new high. And on an inflation-adjusted basis, not one index in the United States is at a new all-time high. Let's look at why it's possible that the final bull market peak is in force. In other words, why you could be short, and why you could suggest that even on a non-inflation adjusted basis, why is it possible that the February 23rd peak, the S&P 500, will be the final bull market peak? Why is that possible? Now, we have a table, four-page table, we call technicals at the high. We look at every high in the S&P 500 and in the other indices since February 9th, 1966. And we look at the technical indicators and some fundamental indicators that occurred at those highs. And in fact, on February 23rd, 2024, only one of these series of indicators was not at a level which was consistent with final bull market peaks. For example, let's look at some fundamentals. Let's look at interest rates. The 30-year T-bond on a six-month basis has gained, its yield has gained 2.34% over the last 6 months. That's on page four of our table. And historically, bull market peaks have occurred anywhere between a 1.82% gain in the six-month yield and an 11.98% decline in yield. So the fact that the yields are up 2.34% is consistent with what yields do at bull market peaks. That's on a six-month basis. On a one-year basis, the long bond yield has gained 10.91%. In other words, bonds have gone down, yields have moved up 10.91%. Which again, roughly, is at the median you see at a bull market peak. The median is 10.61%.
Milton, is this the value of the bond has gone up or the...
No, the yield has gone up. Value bond has gone down. We're looking at the change in yields. If the yield goes up from 4% to 4.5%, that's like an 11% gain in yield. We're looking at an upward slope in yields. The 30-year bond is now yielding more than it yielded a year ago, which means it's priced lower than it was a year ago. And at bull market peaks, that's something you normally see. And the 10.91% gain in yield is actually roughly at the median. You see at bull market peaks, the median is 10.61%.
Milton, you forgive me. I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't bring up the point, though, and I'm sure you've thought about Please. This. But if the 30-year bond is at 10% and it goes to 10.5%, so it's a move of 50 basis points, it's up, quote, 5% in terms of yields. But if it goes from 50 basis points to 100 basis points, the same move in terms of basis points, that will be up 100%. So, you know, a move in the 1980s would be understated as opposed to, you know, if the Fed funds rate is at 1 basis point and it goes to 3 basis points, it's tripled, but that doesn't mean it's high.
Right. That's true. But we're not talking about how we're talking about rate of change in yield. And we're going back to 1966. So we're looking at all bull market peaks. The point is if yields, for example, would be down 40% over the last year, that would be totally inconsistent with what you see at bull market peaks. Or if the six-month yield would be down 12%, six-month yield would be down 12%, you never had a bull market peak took place when yields were down 12% over the previous 6 months. The point being is, this is just one of the things we're looking at. Everything we look at that took place previous bull market peaks is consistent. Let's look at some other things, for example. Let's look at some Fed policy. Typically, bull markets peak after two negative changes in Fed policy. Negative meaning the median is the Fed raises rates twice and then the market peaks. That's the historically that has been the case. Fed moves. Yeah, it's on page two, column Fed moves. The median is two Fed moves at a market peak. The maximum, the most we ever saw before the market peaked was at the 2007 peak when the Fed raised rates 17 times. If you recall, they're raising incremental rates 0.25% at a time, quite a number of years, but it took 17 moves before the market peaked. They actually lowered rates before the S&P actually made its final high, by the way. It's another story. We've actually seen 11 moves of Fed tightening, 11 times, which is totally consistent with what you see at a bull market peak. Now, people are arguing, well, the Fed's going to loosen, they're going to loosen, they're going to loosen. We don't really, the data we look at is not what people think. The data we look at is what has actually happened. What actually happened is interest rates are up on a six-month basis and a 30-year basis, and a 12-month basis. And the Fed has raised rates 11 times without lowering rates. Historically, the median is two. The most you ever needed was 17, and now we have 11. The point is Fed action is consistent is what you see at market peaks. This is all fundamental type of work. But there's many other things we look at. For example, we look at the 60-day put-call ratio. We look at the 10-day equity put-call ratio. We look at the intraday volatility on a 44-day basis. We look at the percentage of stocks in the S&P 600 trading above their 10-week moving average. We look at the percentage of S&P 500 stocks above the 10-week moving average. We look at the 12-day moving average of New York Stock Exchange advancing volume or declining volume. A whole slew of indicators. And it only takes is three or four or five of these indicators not to be consistent with the market peak to tell you that the market can't peak here because it never did. Currently, there's only one indicator that took place that tells you that the market should not peak on February 23rd, and that was the number of new highs. The greatest number of new highs in the S&P 500 at a market peak was 87, and that took place at the 2011 peak. If you recall, there was a mini financial crisis in Europe. The S&P peaked on April 29th. There were 87 new highs in the S&P. It declined 19.39% into its October low. Now we're at 95. By the way, at last night's close, there were only 54 new highs. And at the next close on last Friday, 95 is the level. This is on page one.
Okay,
you see the red, the pink 95?
Yes.
Pink is the only pink you see on the sheet. It's the only one inconsistent with the market peak.
So that would mean breadth in the S&P 500 is 95 stocks are at 52 weeks high, which means it's kind of a broader market. So normally at a technical top, only a handful.
Market peak, the median number of new highs at a final bull market peak of 48. The median number of new highs in the S&P 500 is 48. I mean, less than 10% of the stocks made a new high along with the market. The maximum we've ever seen is 87. Now you've seen 95. So you can argue you can't have a bull market peak when there's only 95.
Contrary to popular wisdom or what you hear people say, breadth is actually not too weak for the bull market to continue. Breadth is actually too strong because there are too many.
Exactly. Yes. And yes, truly, that is actually the case. People look at breadth in a very strange way. We look at breadth in a totally different way, which maybe we'll get to in a moment. But looking at new highs, which is a measure of breadth, 95 new highs. Now you can argue. This might be caused by ETF trading. You know, going back to 1966, you didn't see ETF trading, and you did see it in 2011. Maybe that's why you got the 87. But the reality is we stick to the data, 95 a little bit too high. But I think one indicator is not enough to challenge the idea that we may be at a final bull market high. And on the other hand, maybe the market makes a minor new high in the next week or so, and you won't see 95. You'll see only, today is 54. The market makes a high 3 days ago. Maybe from now, maybe only see 85 or 84. You don't really know. But I'm still calling. We're currently only 30% short. We're not 100% short yet. We'll get to that in a moment. There's no reason. Maybe you can give me a reason why we can't be at a final bull market peak. I mean, I want to go through. I have many other indicators to look at. But one reason is because Milton Berg's indicators signaled in November, and we only met the minimum objective. We haven't met the maximum objective. But other than the things that we do, I don't know why anyone would suggest that we cannot be at a final bull market peak. I don't know why. I mean, people are saying momentum and people are saying AI. The reality is you have blow-off type action, you have very strong market action, which is very consistent generally with what you see at bull markets. And the indicators that we look at bull markets, even the fundamental recessionary indicators. Now, we haven't had a recession yet, but things are lining up for a recession, or at least a major slowdown, which when that takes place when the market's at a peak, usually calls for a correction or a bear market. Has anyone of your guests given any reason why we cannot have a final bull market peak right now? Is there any strong reason why the S&P 500 could not have made its final peak on February 23rd? I don't know of any.
Well, Milton, you're only one of a handful of technical analysts I interview, but a fundamental reason is...
Even on a fundamental basis. On a valuation basis, way overvalued than nearly we've ever been. The interest rates are still high. They're hoping it goes lower, but right now they're still high. Inflation, the way people measure inflation, is still higher than it should be. And I don't know why. I haven't heard any good reason why this cannot be the final high in the market, except people are so convinced that the kind of action we saw, the momentum we've seen, will continue. And something we'll discuss a little bit later, is that actually correct? Is this momentum a bullish sign or possibly a bearish sign? We'll get to that in a moment.
So Milton, I'll without endorsing these views myself, I'll just throw a few pitches at you about fundamental reasons why the market could go higher, why this isn't a top. Inflation has fallen like a rock. You know, officially, what the Fed measures is around 3%, still above the Fed's measure of 2%. As inflation falls and nominal interest rates stay where they are, the nominal Fed funds rate stays where it is. Real interest rates are more restrictive. Actually, you said this in our previous interview. You were early to the party on that. And so the Federal Reserve should cut, which should stimulate the economy. even though on a back tested basis, you know, that's its own story. Earnings.
Well, that's a negative. It's not a positive. So far, they haven't cut. So right now we have high real interest rates and they haven't cut. That's a negative.
Correct. But it's that they will cut.
Well, again, if you're going to try to project what the Fed does, it's easy to project what the market will do than to project what the Fed will do. So let's not try to project what the Fed will do. When they do it, we'll say, well, they cut. Let's see what happens now. Remember, they cut in September of 2007 and the market peaked in October. So they cut the Russell peaked in July, but the S&P peaked in October and the Nasdaq peaked in October. They cut in September. So let's wait for them to cut and see what happens then. And right now, where they have not yet cut, and there are still debates whether they will cut or not, you can't say it's bullish cut, they will cut, because when they will cut, it will be bullish, but they haven't cut. So I don't think that's a logical argument. I don't think so.
Fair enough. Another one is earnings. So a handful of stocks, mostly the large cap technology stocks, their earnings peaked in 2021, and they had a really bad, brutal year in terms of fundamentals for 2022, because, you know, Mark Zuckerberg was spending billions of dollars on this video game or whatever. But, you know, they've found cost discipline, and they're growing their top line and they're shrinking their bottom line. So that's why, you know, a lot of the story of the Magnificent Seven rally has been justified by fundamentals. I mean, NVIDIA more than doubled its revenue. So the fundamentals are there in the big cap tech stocks.
It is very true that earnings are coming in, but guess what? At nearly every bull market peak, earnings were coming in. The market anticipates a change in earnings 6 months, 8 months, 12 months later on. Earnings have nothing to do with the stock market. Stock markets always peak in anticipation. So you could say analysts are saying that earnings will continue. Analysts are, you can flip a coin and it'd be just as right about the analysts as far as earnings go. So you have to say the fact that earnings are strong has nothing to do with the market's peaks. Markets always peak when earnings are strong. Actually, markets always peak when economists say there won't be a recession, or if there's a recession, or if there's a landing, it'll be a soft landing. Markets don't peak when people are expecting a recession. As you know, in our interview a year ago, one of the arguments we made that the market can't be declining any further, because everyone and their aunt was convinced that there's a recession ahead of us. Now, my aunt no longer expects a recession, and now this is what you see at a market peak. So I really have not, Jack, you could prove me wrong, but I see no reason to say that the market can't be making a final peak at the current time. I see no reason for that at all. And we'll get to some further information. I was trying to show the bullish indications that we have. We have a number of bullish indications, because in the back of my mind, the reason the market can't peak is because of the technical buy signal we received. On the other hand, some of the action that we've seen, and the fact that the technicals at the high, that table, the fact that it's almost totally consistent with what you see in bull market peaks, combined with other facts that we have, suggests that we think there might be a bull market peak ahead of us.
But so, Milton, can we go through? I mean, you mentioned them, a lot of them, very quickly, and we can put them on screen. But which are the most convincing signals to you, or are they all convincing? I mean, you talked about advanced decline.
Convincing that the market be ahead. Well, you have to really. This only makes sense when all of them are consistent with the peak. In other words, there's no one indicator that's going to tell you that the market is going to peak. There are some other technical indicators we haven't got to. I'm talking about things you can put on a table. Some of the things we're going to talk about are things you really can't put on a table. We'll show in chart form.
Milton, so I just want to clarify for the audience. So it's not the one individual reading. It's the constellation of the readings
right.
You know, you're checking all of these things and
telling me that a market could peak. Then there's other indicators we'll get to in a moment with telling me that the market is peaking. In other words, the market can go up another 6%, even though the market, the indicators we're looking at are consistent with the peak. The question is, besides being consistent with the peak, are there other factors that tell you the market is peaking? And that's really the kind of things we want to talk about. We didn't get to that yet.
Milton, sorry, have these technicals at the high readings, have they ever been triggered in the constellation of factors at a bottom or in the middle of a bull market?
No, never at a bottom. But there are instances where the market continues 6% or 7% higher and then makes its peak. It's not going to pinpoint February 23rd as a peak. I'm trying to suggest it's possible that February 23rd is the final peak. You know, we're short. We're not heavily short at this point. The S&P is down 11 points today. It's still peaked on February 23rd. We'll get to that in a minute. But we're going to increase short exposure as we get more convinced that was the final high. Now, why would February 23rd be the final high? We'll get that a little later. I just want to say is that the background is consistent with the high. If put-call ratios on a 10-day basis would be, at 1.3, there's no way the market would be peaking at that point. If the Federal Reserve lowered rates 14 times currently, there's no way you could be at a market peak, you see. But the Federal Reserve has raised rates 11 times, and the put-call ratios are low, and sentiment is very, very extreme. and the breadth is at levels that you see at bull market peaks. But let's get to. I think we should get to. It's up to you, but there are many more other things we can get to. I want to stress there are many bullish background reasons to be bullish. It's not the kind of things I hear from analysts, because analysts don't have the same kind of indicators that I have. I mean, even on February 14th, for example, the Russell 2000 gained 2%. Its AD line was greater than 8-1 on February 14th. Yet I think at the prior day, February 13th was that big down day, and it had 8-1 downside volume to upside volume. That 8-1 downside volume, upside volume one day, next to 8 times as much upside advances as declines. And the trend at that point, 25-day trend, was 1.25, which is to the high side. And that has occurred only 3 times before, all times followed by strong, strong bull moves in the stock market, in the S&P. You saw it on March 10th, 2009, April 2nd, 2009, and May 21st, 2012. Each of these cases, the market gained 61%, 45%, 69% before the next 10% correction. So there are reasons, things that I look at that suggest the market could go higher. However, these are offset by other things that I'm seeing in the marketplace, which suggests that the market actually is making a peak. And all the so-called momentum that we're seeing in January and February are negative momentum rather than positive momentum, because it's taking place not, climbing a wall of worry. It's taking place when there's no wall of worry.
What do you mean by that?
When everyone is bullish, it's not bullish. Momentum is great when the momentum is unexpected and taking place when people are expected a declining market rather than an advancing market. When you see strong momentum because everyone and his friend is buying stocks because the AI craze, when you see momentum at that point, that is momentum you see at the top, which is the kind of thing I like to point out a little later. So I say, yes, February 14th, we had a buy signal, which in the past, it only happened 4 times in the past, but the gains are 45, 65, 69% for the next 10% correction. On the other hand, first, it's not one of our greatest indicators, because it's just based on the Russell and based on just a few factors. But on the other hand, sometimes strong momentum rather than being bullish is bearish, which is, it's clear, you see that clearly in commodities. And my argument actually is that the kind of action we're seeing in stocks now is commodity-like action, where momentum rather than being bullish, momentum is actually bearish. In commodities, markets peak on strong momentum. Generally, the S&P 500 peaks on low momentum. But there are times that markets act as if they are commodities. For example, in 2000, the Nasdaq peaked on high momentum. It didn't peak on low momentum.
So, Milton, how do you judge whether it's good momentum or bad momentum?
Well, the momentum is always good. Momentum is always momentum. It's either good or bad. It's in context of when is it taking place. If strong momentum is taking place when people are skeptical of the market, or when the market is within a month or two off a low, or for a significant low, then momentum is good. For example, if I was convinced that the low in the Russell on October 27th, 2023, was a bear market low for the broad market, this momentum coming a quarter of a year after that low is really very bullish. However, since I know and you know that the real bull market low, bear market low, took place in October of 2022, and now we're 18 months roughly past that low, this momentum may no longer be bullish momentum, especially since there are other factors that are taking place that are totally consistent with the market peaks. And we'll see in a moment, there's reasons to think that this action is commodity-like rather than stock market-like action. There are many other bullish things we can talk about.
So you named a few reasons to be bullish, a few reasons to be bearish. What gives you confidence, Milton, that, okay, things are maybe a little extreme. The momentum is feverish. Let's say the greed index is at 70, but as you know, the greed index is at 70, it can go to 100. Like, people were maybe too bullish and the end of 1998, but that didn't stop a blow off top that was, a very painful to be short. So how does this differ from a late bull market that is going to explode to a blow off top?
Right, right. And I can't say that will not happen. I can't say that will happen, but I'm suggesting we're at the blow off top. Let me give you a little indication. I don't want to talk about the fundamentals, but let's accept the fact that it's possible we will have a recession in late 2024. Let's not discount and say we cannot have a recession. I mean, you had many great economists on your show, and they're saying the business cycle has not been violated. The leading indicators are down 23 months in a row. Of course, the momentum of the decline has slowed a little bit, but leading indicators are down 23 months in a row, which is typical of what you see prior to recessions. The real inverted yield curve using the 90-day and the 10-year It's, I think it's 14 months since it inverted. Normally, the recession begins 13 months after it inverted, so it's just 1 month later off the typical. There are many reasons to believe or to say we could have a recession. As much as people are saying the Fed is going to loosen, let's assume that's even a bullish factor, but if they're going to loosen because there's a recession, it's not necessarily bullish after the market has rallied. You know, if the market would be down 30%, it would be October of 2022, and then the people will say, you know, the inflation is down and the Fed is probably going to loosen. If they do loosen, that might be bullish. But if they're loosening with the market at an all-time high on a non-inflation adjusted basis, it's not necessarily a reason to be bullish. As I say, the market made an all-time high in October of 2007. S&P an all-time high, while the S&P, the Fed actually loosened the lowered rates in September of 2007. So you know, it's not that simple that just because people think the Fed will lower rates is a reason to believe that the market is going to go higher. Let's look at one major aberration. One thing is so strange in this market, we've never seen it before, okay? And that is the banking index, the BKX. You know, banks are a very important part of our economy. At major market lows, for example, in 2002, October 9, 2002, both the S&P 500 and the KBW banking index bottomed the exact same date, October 9, 2002, which was the final low in a bear market. On March 9, 2009, the S&P made a final bear market low, a devastating bear market down 50%. And the BKX, the KBW banking index, actually made its low a day before. So it led by a day, but basically the bottom at the exact same time, of March 6, 2009 and March 9, 2009. Even the mini bear market in 2011, which was a 19% decline in the S&P 500, we call that a mini bear market, the S&P 500 and the banking index both bottomed for the final low in the bear market on October 3rd, 2011. So too, at the correction in 2016, the S&P 500 and the banking index both bottomed on February 11, 2016. December 24th, 2018, the S&P and the banking index bottomed the exact same day. And on March 23rd, 2020, after the COVID crisis, the banking index, the S&P 500 bottomed the same exact same day. Lo and behold, we have a new bear market that began in 2021, November, or 2022, January. For the banking index, actually began in January along with the S&P. The S&P declined somewhat, 22, 23, 25% into October 2022. And the banking index declined 60% and didn't bottom until May or October, actually, of 2023. There's a major divergence, meaning the banking index is lagging the low in the S&P 500.
And normally it is coincidence.
Normally coincidence. So you have to ask, why is it not coincident?
Well, I can throw a ton of fundamental reasons at you that, you know, longtime listeners to the show definitely will. We've covered the banks a lot on forward guidance. Yeah. But hasn't there been a huge rally in the banks from October to late January?
Oh, well, hadn't there been a huge rally in China from October 2022 to January? It was up 60%. No one's going to argue that China's healthy just because once had a huge rally. Huge rallies are quite common in bear markets.
But they climbed the wall of worry, didn't they? Positive momentum as everyone is bearish, right?
No, by the time it got up 60%, people were no longer bearish in China. China was up from October to January. How many months is that? That's 3 months? Up 60%. If you recall at the time, people were convinced that the low was in it, and you know, China, at that time, China, they made some policy changes. So I'm just trying to point out, your argument. Let's see what the banking index has done. Let me actually get the exact gain we've seen. The banking index generated its intraday peak on May 9th, 2023, and it gained 39.56% in 185 days. I mean, considering it was down 60%, that is not a tremendous up move for that index. The reality is, we have to ask yourself, why has banks continued lower, even though the S&P 500 was going higher? Why is that? I don't know. I'm a technical analyst. I don't know why it is. I just know that it's different, and this difference may make a difference. Maybe it doesn't make a difference, but this is some major difference between this bull market, and it's not just the banking index, as you know. It's other indices as well. It's the small cap indices. The Russell 2000, for example, or even the S&P small cap indexes, let me see SML, S&P small cap, made the bear market lows, not along with the S&P and with the NASDAQ, but they made the bear market lows in October of 2023. Well, yes, there's something different about this market. I'm not talking about breadth and broadening of the market. I'm talking about actually directional action. Markets are making lows while the S&P 500 was way off, way off its lows. It weren't coincidence. Something different about this market. Now, difference might be what I was saying earlier is that the real bull market peak occurred in 2021, 2022. On an inflation-adjusted basis, we're not at a new high. And all these rallies are ultimately going to be considered bear market rallies on an inflation-adjusted basis. As long as you don't make a new high, these rallies will be considered bear market rallies. Anyway, it's the first point I want to point out. We have to understand that, anyway, that's chart 15, just for your, you know, BKX, SPX. We see the divergence between the banking indices and the S&P indices. And it's very, very strange because usually, you know, it's a banking, it's a financial system that is in trouble during a bear market. And usually by the time that bottoms, the S&P is going to bottom and people know, and that hasn't happened this time. It's just one piece of information. So now there's another thing to look at. And that is a reason to even be bullish or bearish. It depends how you look at markets. Let's look at blow-off tops. The S&P 500, going back to 1957, has had a number of blow-off tops. Blow-off tops meaning a sharp gain over a short period of time after a correction within a bull market. So we had a 10.28% correction into October 27th. And since then, in 63 days, the S&P has gained 23.59%. Now, that sounds quite amazing. 10% correction in the bull market and 63 days of 23.59%, quite amazing. The question is, can this be considered blow-off type action based on percentage changes? Now, let's look at historical blow-off action. 1957, the S&P peaked up 15.9% in 105 days. In 1968, the S&P gained 23.54% in 164 days after a 10% correction. And then you see 12% in 73 to the top, 18% in 1980, 21% in 1987, in 67 days. So our 23.59% gain in 80 days is at the high end of a blow-off. You might argue it can't be a blow-off, it just gained too much in an 80-day period.
Yeah, it's too strong, Milton. It's too strong.
However, at 1929 peak, the Dow Jones Industrials gained 31.65% in 77 days, and the S&P, which wasn't 500, I think it was 90 stocks then, gained 29.90% in 82 days. So we're up 23.59% in 80 days compared to 31.29% in 77, 82 days. So if this is a blow-off, it's the type of blow-off we saw at that major historic bull market peak in 1929 and maybe similar to 1968, where you saw 23.54%, but that took 164 days as opposed to our 80 days.
And so Milton, let me define for the audience, a blow-off top is when you have a correction in a bull market and then an explosive thrust upwards before a bear market begins.
Right. Now, you see it in commodities all the time. You don't see it in stocks all the time. And I'm trying to argue that the S&P and the NASDAQ and the AI stocks are acting commodity-like rather than stock market-like. And the last time we saw this type of action really was 1929. I don't want to compare our market to 1929. I just want to say is that that blow-off top was very similar to the type of, if this is a blow-off, I mean, you can argue this is just a momentum surge and it's going to go much higher. We'll see reasons why we doubt that. But right now, I'd say it's most comparison to 1929 and to 1968. 1968 was also a very major market top. As you know, we'll get on a point that on inflation-adjusted basis, the market peaked in 66. In our case, the market peaked in 2021 and is now 2024. And then it didn't bottom until 1982. So I don't know when we'll bottom if this is actually a top. That's the next thing to look at.
Oh, how many instances, in other words, a 10% decline followed by a pretty vigorous 24% rally. That's what we've had since November 1st. How many times has that occurred as during a bull market versus 1929, right? There's only been one 1929. Whereas I imagine it must have happened a lot during a bull market.
You know, I'm going to have to check into that. I don't think it happened at all in a bull market. You have to realize a 23.59% gain in 80 days after just a 10% correction is not normal action in the S&P 500. I mean, people are recognizing that. People are saying, you know, this is a historic move in the stock market. Yes, it's a historic move. Is it bullish or is it bearish? That's really the question. I agree it's a historic move. But, Jack, I will check that out for you because I'm curious as well. Whether we've seen that at all. Okay, I'm curious as well. I think we may have just seen it in 1999 to 2000, I believe. In July in 1999, you had a correction of 10%, And then it, yeah, the blow off into March. So that might be the only time you've seen it, which was a blow off top. In 2000, I showed 14.5% in 19 days. That was the final 19 days. It was far greater than that in the NASDAQ. And I'll have to get the data for you. But whether within an extending bull market, you saw that, highly unlikely. But I will check it out, okay? Now, let's look at some other things. Let's look at the Russell 2000. Let's look at the equal weight indices. And many people have been talking about the equal weight indices. And how are the equal weight indices giving us any clues to what's really going on in the stock market? So the most important thing that I've noticed about the Russell 2000 equal weight index, which you don't get on Bloomberg, is that the latest high on December 27th was below the February 2nd high on an equal weighted basis. So while on a nominal basis, the Russell 2000 is above its bear market rally highs in August, in July of 2022 and in February of 2023 and so on. On an equal weighted basis, the Russell 2000's current high is below its high of February 2nd, 2022. Now, very, very strange, because when you talk about equal weighted, the Russell 2000 should do as well as the S&P, because you're not looking at cap weighting, you're looking at just underlying stock action. If we're in a real bull market, why has the latest gain in the S&P in the Russell not taken you above its February 2nd high? It took it on a nominal basis, excuse me, on a cap weighted basis, it did, but it didn't take it on an equal weighted basis. I think that's some negative to look at, telling you something strange about this market. This nice bull move in the Russell 2000 is inconsistent with what you'd expect in a real bull market in the Russell 2000.
Which nice bull move? The one starting in late October 2023?
Yeah, well, the Russell bottomed in October 2023, and it had its greatest rally, you know, since going back over a year. It's greatest percentage gain. I can get that in a minute. But the reality is, although it's the greatest percentage gain, on an equal weighted basis, it wasn't able to go above its February 2nd high, although it did get above it on a cap-weighted basis. Then I look at the equal-weighted S&P 1500. We look at the S&P 600, 400, and 500. On an equal-weighted basis, the S&P 1500, again, it's way above its January 3rd, 2022 high. But on an equal-weighted basis, it's also below its January 2023 high. It's actually below its December 27th high of this year. December 27th, 2023, was higher on an equal-weighted basis than February 23rd, 2024, which is really, really, very strange considering the momentum we've seen. If the momentum is real momentum and if the breath is real breath, it's very strange that an equal-weighted S&P 1500 is not above its high. Now, I wanted to, in the chart in 18, the last chart, chart 4 in number 18, I showed that at the peak in the year 2000, the S&P 1500 equal-weighted index continued higher after the peak in the S&P 1500 cap weight index. Was totally opposite its situation. The S&P peaked in March, and the equal weight index didn't peak until early 2002. Very strange. So, you know, the equal weight, it doesn't always move along with the, but in this case, what you're seeing is the S&P 500, S&P 1500 peaking in 2022, while the S&P, while the cap weight is peaking now. So, I don't know, just strange type of action. Strange type of action tells you maybe something's different. S&P 500, on the other hand, S&P 500 is showing the same thing. Basically, the S&P 500, and this, yeah, in the year 2000, not the all 1500 stocks, the S&P 500 in the year 2000 peaked on an equal basis, peaked before the March 2000 peak in the S&P 500 cap weighted index. So let me get this straight. The S&P 500 unweighted, number one, it's below its high of its all-time high of January 2022, and it's interesting that at the peak in March 24th, 2000, the S&P equal weight also was not able to exceed its high of July 1999.
And so equal weight is all of the stocks in the basket, however many they are, they have the exact equal weighting, whereas in the S&P 500, you know, Apple is 7%, NVIDIA is 6%, that kind of stuff.
Right. No, they're all equally weighted. Rebalance, the Bloomberg rebalances their index once a month. We rebalance ours daily. And in any event, the pattern you're seeing now matches the pattern of 2000. And the S&P 1500, it does not. Smaller caps continued higher. But the S&P 500, which peaked in 2000, it peaked in 1990, in July 1999. And it's, well, the S&P cap weight index peaked in March of 2000. In our case, the S&P equal weighted peaked in January of 2022, while the cap rate index may be peaking now in February of 2024.
Like gold did, Bitcoin is establishing itself as a macro asset that potentially helps hedge against the government devaluation of your money. Finally, you can easily access Bitcoin in a low-cost ETF with the VanEck Bitcoin Trust, ticker HODL. Search the ticker HODL in your brokerage app today. Visit VanEck.com/HODLFG to learn more. That's VanEck.com/HODLFG. Now the disclosures. Investing involves risk and you could lose money on an investment in the VanEck Bitcoin Trust, also known as the Trust or HODL. The value of Bitcoin and therefore the value of the Trust shares could decline rapidly, including to zero. You could lose your entire principal investment. For a more complete discussion of the risk factors relative to the Trust, carefully read the prospectus link below. Thanks. Let's get back to the interview.
Milton, what does it indicate about the market when the equal weight fails to peak, or if it peaks after the peak of the market cap weighted action? You know, some people say, okay, the Russell 2000 stocks or the smaller cap stocks, they're more economically sensitive. A lot of them are unprofitable. I think there's a quality issue because there's so many IPOs, but that's a non-technical factor. So it's bearish. In other words, the amount of advancing stocks gets narrower and narrower and breadth declines, ultimately leading to a pullback.
In a normal healthy market, these indices move together. We said the banking index moves along with the S&P 500 in a normal healthy market. Normal healthy market, the equal weighted and the cap weighted move in the same direction.
All right, but Milton, in our prior interview, and I just listened to it, you said, I brought up breadth, and you said that actually narrow breadth does not necessarily concern you. I'll paraphrase it, and you correct me it's always the case that construction industries are going to do good and that the banks don't do good, or there's going to be some leaders and some laggards, and that's part of capitalism, that's part of growth.
I'm talking in terms of relative strength. At bull market peaks, there's a group or a select small number of groups that are showing much stronger relative strength than other groups that are still rising. In other words, we're talking about relative strength, but they are still moving in the same direction. They're still making new highs. But just, in other words, the oils will make new highs up 10%, while technology making new highs up 20%. But in this instance, you're not seeing new highs. You're seeing they're moving in the same direction, but they're not making new highs. So that's a little different concept.
But Milton, wasn't it true that the Russell 2000 was a laggard last year too, as the S&P 500 was going up?
I'll make a big picture call here. You're right. Yeah. It's a big picture call. I'm saying that the great bull market we've seen since October 2022, maybe in retrospect, won't be considered a great bull market at all. First of all, on an inflation-adjusted basis, we're not at new highs. Second of all, with the fact that the banks lagged and the Russell lagged, there's something very, very strange about this so-called great bull market. It's just not typical to see in a great bull market. And the same argument could have been made in March of 2000 when the S&P was doing great and the NASDAQ was doing great, but the equal weight S&P was not doing great. So you can say, it's very similar. So I'm making a big picture call. In other words, these perma bears out there, and these perma bears who are looking for a 60% decline in the S&P, and they've been saying it all along, they may finally be right. But, the timing was terribly wrong. But now they may finally be right, because now you're starting to see technical divergences that you didn't see in January of 2022. You're seeing the kind of technical divergences you saw in March of 2000, the same kind of blow-offs you saw in 1929. You didn't see that earlier to make that 60% call for 60% decline. But now it's possible, if this is a peak, this might be a more important peak than the peak we saw in March, in January of 2022 or in November 2021 in the NASDAQ. It's definitely far greater speculation in the NASDAQ. Listen, there was far greater speculation in these crazy ARK-type stocks, Cathie Woods-type stocks, far greater speculation in 2020, 2021 than you're seeing now.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah.
Absolutely. Greatest. But as far as the real solid companies with good balance sheets and good earnings, there's far greater speculation now than you saw either in 2000 or in 2021. I mean, 2000, because Amazon was one of the speculative stocks, but you had pets.com. You had all these crazy, crazy companies that didn't know how they're going to show earnings. And you saw that again in 2021, in a sense. You saw it in the SPAC and so on. Mm-hmm. But now you're seeing speculation in real companies. Wow. So people argue, since they're real companies, it's not speculation. But as Benjamin Graham would say, if you're paying more than the company's worth, you're speculating, regardless of how great the balance sheet is and how great the prospects of earnings are. If you're overpaying, you're speculating. If you're underpaying, you're investing. And I would say there's more speculation now than you saw at the 2000 peak. I'm talking of blue chip stock and good stocks, far more than you saw now, far more than you saw at the 2022 peak, no question about it.
Milton, but how often is it that a bull market peaks when there is speculation only in high quality companies that are growing their earnings consistently in a high quality manner? In other words, the orgy of speculation doesn't flow over into the low cap companies, and you have, you know, CEOs that have never made a penny of revenue in the company's life talking about how they're basically, you know, they can, you know, bring people back to life, basically. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, most analysts compare this market in a sense to the 1973 peak with the Nifty 50. Polaroid, Eastman, Kodak, you know, both those companies don't exist any longer. McDonald's is one of them, which has had a great run over the last 50 years. So McDonald's is one of the Nifty 50. But, you know, you had they compare it to that instance where the small cap stocks peaked in 68, never made a new high in 1973, while the blue chips made significantly higher highs on a non-inflation adjusted basis in 1973. Of course, on an inflation adjusted basis, none of them made new highs. So you could compare, that's one instance. In the past, you could in 2000, you did not see speculation in blue chips. No, you saw speculation in companies that really, well, Amazon in retrospect became a great company, but you didn't know it in the year 2000. Maybe some people knew it, but most people didn't recognize the value of Amazon until years later. Look at the Warren Buffett. He now praises Amazon, but he was, I remember the interview he had with Forbes when he said, you know, he talked about the, you know, how many airline companies began, and, you know, after the Wright brothers, and how many of them were under, how many car companies began. He said, look how many internet companies are beginning. They're probably going to be bankrupt. Meanwhile, Jeff Bezos says he read that interview, and based on that interview, he changed his method of managing the company. He didn't want Buffett to be right. So nobody recognized that in 2000 that Amazon would be what it became. And you look at Apple. I mean, Warren Buffett didn't invest in Apple until 30 years after they became a great company. So
right. But I'm saying, you know, there is a someone, an influencer, I won't name his name, but people probably will know who I'm talking about, who in, you know, 2020 and 2021 was saying, oh, I'm making so much money buying stocks. I mean, Warren Buffett, he's, you know, he's, maybe he was good back in the day, but I'm better than Warren Buffett.
Yeah.
You're not seeing the, you know, orgy of speculation, to use that, you know, vulgar phrase, of people saying, you know, Warren, he's old, he's forgotten it.
We're not seeing that. But you are seeing more sophisticated speculation, you see. You see rational people who manage real money for institutions who are basically saying, you know, this is a new internet. Maybe they'll be right, but
yeah. Or they're saying, I'm gonna get fired and not gonna get my bonus if I don't own NVIDIA.
Exactly. Let's see something else over here. This is all very quite significant. We pointed out that at bear market lows, the real bear market lows, the banking index and the S&P bottom within days of each other or the exact same day. What about at market peaks? Now at peaks in bear market rallies, believe it or not, the Russell 2000 and the S&P 500 peaked roughly the same day. So at the, you know, you got a bear market began in 2021-22. At the March bear market rally, the Russell and the S&P peaked on the same day. At the August peak in August 2022 bear market rally peak, the Russell and the S&P peaked on the same day. At the February 2nd bear market rally peak, the S&P 500 and the Russell peaked on the same day. Now, for S&P, it wasn't a bear market rally, but basically, at bull market peaks, you see something totally different. At bull market peaks, for example, at the November 8th, 2021 peak in the Russell 2000, the S&P didn't peak until January 3rd, 2002. So it was a 38-day divergence. Russell peaked 38 days before the S&P did. Again, at the 2018 peak, the S&P peaked on September 20th, 2018, while the Russell peaked on August 31st, a 13-day divergence, or August 31st, 2018. Which is a 13-day divergence, the Russell led. In 2007, the Russell peaked on July 13th, 2007, and the S&P peaked on October 9th, which was a 61-day divergence. In the year 2000, the Russell peaked on March 9th, 2000, while the S&P peaked on March 24th, 2000, for an 11-day divergence. And in 1998, the S&P peaked on July 17th, while the Russell peaked on April 21st for a 61-day divergence.
So the S&P usually peaks after the Russell.
After the Russell. Now, currently, assuming the February 23rd high holds, assuming the high in the Russell holds, the Russell peaked on December 27th, 2023. And I think that high is holding. Let's see where we are. They were close to that high again, but the Russell's down 7 points. Yeah, so that high is still holding. The December 27th, 2023 high is holding. And the S&P peaked on February 23rd, a 39-day divergence. Now, the median is 38 days. We're now 39 days. This is typical action at a bull market peak. And the logic is, you know, people are going to chase the high-quality blue chips, high-quality S&P stocks into a top and ignore the lower quality stocks out of the market top. And that's exactly what has happened in the past, exactly what's happening now. So I think that's another indication that perhaps we're seeing a major market peak coming up in the S&P 500, which was led by the Russell 2000, which is very, very, very typical.
Milton, couldn't you have said that in last year as the S&P 500 was rallying steadily and the NASDAQ was rallying steady, but the Russell was faltering?
No, Russell was not faltering. Russell was actually making peaks along with the S&P. It's just that the Russell had a bull market peak earlier. But during that rally to the S&P high in August 2000, for example, the high in July 31st, I'll give you exact numbers. The S&P made a high on July 31st. Index GPO, it made its closing high, intraday high on July 31st last year. Let's see what the Russell did. And the Russell made its high last year on July 31st, exact same time, you see. I say bear market rally peaks, they move in the same direction. It's at the final peak in the bull market that you see the Russell lagging and the S&P 500. S&P 500 continuing higher. So you couldn't make that argument then, actually, because this is the first time since January of 2022 that the S&P made a high that was not accompanied by a Russell high, not an all-time high, but by a Russell high in the same up move. In other words, let's divide the market into various moves, up, down, up, down. When the S&P goes up, the Russell goes up, the S&P peaks, the Russell peaks, even though the Russell peak may be lower than it was a half a year ago. That doesn't matter. In this move, the S&P and the Russell peaked at the same time. In the move off the October lows, though, the S&P peaked on February 23rd, while the Russell peaked on December 27th, which is actually you see at bull market peaks, not actually you see during rallies in bear markets or during really bull market, extending bull market moves. You don't see that.
And Milton, now let's talk about individual stocks, the stocks leading NVIDIA.
Well, before that, we got to get to the most important. I left the most important stuff to the end. So we have to get to the most important stuff. And this is, you have to see the chart for this. This is number 21. S&P 500 is generating a series of upside and downside gaps. This is commodity-like action. Let me give you an example, okay? When you see a gap in a blue chip index is a very rare commodity, very rare thing to see because blue chip stocks, there's no reason for them to gap up or gap down. You know, there's analysis, people follow the companies. They really very, very difficult to get many surprises. And you know, at market peaks, you see gaps. You know, I point out the gap you saw on December 7th, 2021 and December 23rd, 2021, leading to the January 3rd peak in the S&P. So a gap on March 29th, 2022, leading to the next day peak in the S&P 500 on a bear market rally. But let's talk where we are now. So an upside gap, November 2nd, November 1st, November 14th, November 22nd, January 19th, January 22nd, February 2nd, February 7th, February 22nd. Now, gaps coming off a low. Gaps off a low are considered breakaway gaps. They're considered, you know, early move gaps. They're generally bullish when they're coming off a low. Gaps coming off an extended move is considered bearish because they're called exhaustive gaps. It means it's fear of missing out. People are buying stocks regardless of what the fundamentals are. Now, you usually don't see gaps in the S&P 500. You really don't. You usually see gaps in individual stocks. It's very difficult to get gaps in the S&P 500. But look, since January, January 19th, 22nd, February 2nd, February 7th, and finally on February 22nd. But February 22nd wasn't just a gap. February 22nd was the day before the February 23rd final high. And that day, the S&P gained 2.11%, if you recall. And on that day that it gained 2.11%, you have to realize that was its greatest gain in the S&P 500 since August 10th, 2022. It wasn't just a gap up where people say, I'm going to buy above the previous close. It's that they took the market up 2.11%, which was its greatest gain in over a year. The index gapped on the same day up 3.01% for its greatest gain since December 7th, 2021. But guess what?
And that was the day NVIDIA reported earnings?
The point was, volume was light. I think the S&P volume was only the fourth highest in the previous month. So you had a gap up 2.11%, greatest move in over a year, and the volume was the fourth highest in a month. It wasn't even great volume. Breath was very weak on that day. So this is a kind of action, exhaustive action, you see at final market peaks. And guess what? The market did peak the following day. So that's one thing I want to point out. This series of gaps is unheard of in the S&P 500. You look at the chart, when you look at all these gaps since October, people are arguing bullish, 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 great momentum. Look at this. Great. And I'm arguing, yes, it was bullish coming off the lows, and the action has been great off the lows. But the fact that this gap upside action is continuing after you're up 20%, after you're up 22%, And you're seeing this 2.11% gain on low volume. That suggests this is exhaustive, and all of these people who are latecomers to the bull market are going to be possibly holding the bag at these highs.
And a gap is when the market opens up higher and continues to get higher throughout the day?
It doesn't just open up higher. It opens higher than a number of days previously. You can actually see some people misinterpret what gaps are. The fact that a market opens higher doesn't mean it's a gap. If it has to open up higher than the previous, it can't open. It's not enough it opens higher than the previous day's close. It has to open up higher than the previous day's high. It's not enough to open up higher than the previous day's close. That happens very often. There's one great technician, by the way, who keeps making this mistake. I don't know why. He has a newsletter and he keeps making this mistake. He calls a gap when it's not a gap. A gap must open above the previous day's high. A downside gap must open below the previous day's low. And that's a rare event in the S&P. You look at the chart, it's a very rare event in the S&P 500. So that's one reason why this commodity-like action, and therefore what's perceived to be bullish action, momentum, is more like blow-off action with what you're seeing commodities. Russell 2000, I wrote Portrait of a Sick Market. That's the next chart. I just show basically that the Russell 2000 has also seen a series of gaps, December 14th, 22nd, January 3rd, 22nd, February 9th, February 2nd, February 15th, February 27th. And through all those gaps, it wasn't able to make a higher high above the December 27th high. And you saw a gap on the January 3rd, 22nd, February 9th, 12th, 15th, 17th, 27th. And all those gaps, signs of people willing to buy the Russell, still not able to get above its high of December 27th. This, again, is what we call churning at a top. I call churning at a top. It's exhaustive action. It's a sign of a market peak. So this is not healthy action in the Russell 2000. Then I show you however, I show it's 82 days. It's 82 days since the Russell 2000 generated the bear market decline on October 27th. The bear market was down 32.99%. We're now 82 days into the new bull market. Now, what does the Russell 2000 usually do through the 82 in the bull market? Well, in 2020, it was up 49%. In 2009, it was up 43%. In 1998, it was up 32%. In 1999, it was up 34%. In 87, it was up 26%. Currently, it's only up 25%. There's only one instance where it gained less, which was off the 2002 low. It was only up 11% by day 82. But in that case, as you know, the market retested its lows in March of 2003. So you can argue that the Russell is within its parameters of a normal bull market move. However, it really isn't, because ex-2002, the Russell, and considering how long the bull market lasted in the S&P 500, considering the momentum, the unprecedented momentum you're seeing in the S&P 500 off a corrective low, you would have expected the Russell 2000 to gain far more than 25.61% to day 82. Now I want to talk about European markets, if you don't mind. Because it's not only the NVIDIA AI craze that's been taking markets to new highs. The Paris CAC 40 has made a new all-time high in local currency. It's actually up 14.85% above its high of September 4th, 2000. So from September 4th, 2000 to February 23rd, 2023, the Paris CAC in local currency is up 14.85% in 24 years, less than half a percent a year. It's kind of crazy. But the question is, people are arguing that the Paris CAC is breaking out to the upside. Finally broke out above its highs of 2000, and it's now above its high of 2022. And look at that action. It gapped up 3 out of 5 days. It gapped up on January 26th, February 16th, and February 22nd. Now, I understand the argument that is breaking out, but considering that the United States market is in a speculative phase, I think it's highly unlikely that the action you're seeing in Paris is a bullish action. I think it's also just final action that takes place at the end of a bull market. And these three gaps you saw on 26th, February 6th, 22nd, are exhaustive gaps taking place at the end of a move rather than early in a move. And the reason I can say that very simply is because the Paris has gained 41.72% since the September 29th, 2022 low. So it has had a full bull market of 41.72%. So to argue that just because it's above its 2000 high, it's going to break out to the upside, you can make an argument. I'm not saying they're going to be wrong, but at this point, I rather interpret this that the European markets are just following the U.S. markets and assuming that central banks are going to ease, and if central banks are going to ease, it's the bull market, regardless of how overpriced stocks may, regardless of how the fact that socialist economies are ultimately collapse, become worthless. You've seen it all over the world. And Paris, you know, France is basically a socialist type economy. And that's why the market has done nothing for the last 24 years. So I don't think this is a breakout. It might be, but it's still moving in the same way the S&P 500 and NDX moving, even though there's no AI stocks in that index. I think it's a worldwide phenomenon. You're seeing the same thing in Japan. I think it's basically a worldwide phenomenon of speculation into February of 2024, which may ultimately turn into a bull trap or a bull market peak. Now, that's the S&P in Paris adjusted for local currency, in local currency. If you adjust Paris market for the U.S. dollar, it's actually gained 1.45% in 16 years. And that is breaking out above its December 12, 2007 high. But again, this breaking out is taking out a gap. Normally, a breakout in a gap is very bullish, and maybe they'll be right. Maybe it'll break out. At this point, I have to interpret it as being bearish, where the Europeans are looking over the shoulder, looking across the pond to America, seeing a great bull market in America, and saying, how? We need a bull market as well, and let's get in at any cost, even though we're at a new all-time high, both in nominal terms and in U.S. dollar terms. That's how I'm interpreting. Again, I could be wrong, and if I'm wrong, I'll know it soon enough. The market will continue higher. But that's how I'm interpreting what you see. And you see the same thing in Japan, by the way. Japan's finally at a 35-year high, whatever it is. And, you know, Japan, fundamentally, Japan is may have some things going for it. Warren Buffett has been buying Japan. But these markets make new all-time highs all over the world at the same time. When you have this clear speculation in the United States, where I see it, might suggest it's an emotional phase of a final high in the market.
What about China?
I have a chart on China. We traded China pretty well. China bottomed October 4th, 2022, gained 60% to January 27, 2020, and it's on a downtrend. However, its low of October 24th, 2022 has held. On January 22nd of this year, it traded on an intraday basis 1.60% above its low of October 24th, 2022. So that might be a successful test of the low. I actually added two Chinese stocks to my long portfolio. I added Baba and I added Futu. One's a financial stock, one's a retail stock, on the assumption that even if we get a bear market, maybe these stocks that are so far down already will hold. I'm looking for, in my long-only portfolio, which I'll get to in a moment, which is doing exceedingly well this year, up like 18% on the year. We don't use leverage. We only go long stocks. I'm trying to find defensive issues. I'm considering China as a defensive, cheap China stocks as defensive issues. Not that they may go up in price, but maybe they'll go down less in price than U.S. stocks will in the next bear market. But yes, China... I don't want to argue that China tested a low. It's a successful test. But based on chart pattern alone, the tested low on January 22nd may hold. But I think it's highly unlikely that China is going to rally if the United States is peaking. So you could argue, well, China is bottoming, and therefore they'll move up along with the U.S. and France and the worldwide. Or you can argue, well, no, China is a canary in the coal mine. And China was an engine of world growth for quite a number of years. And maybe the fact that China's stock market tested a low on January 22nd, may continue lower, and maybe it will drag down the whole rest of the world. I don't know. I can see it both ways. But China is something we look at very closely. We traded the October 24th, 22nd low because that was the cycle date. And now we want to talk about cycle dates, because when I talk about cycle dates, people usually shut off your show. They say, one way I count was, everything was fine until he started talking about cycle dates. That's why I left cycle dates for the end.
Well, in reviewing, I noticed 28th was the cycle date. That was at the bottom in stocks?
Yeah. October 27th was the cycle date.
Yeah.
The low in China, October 24th, 2022, was a cycle date. So, yeah, cycle dates turn not just stocks, turn many markets. Cycle dates turn the emotions. When there's an emotional market, it basically turns the emotions. I mean, this has been documented by studies in Yale, but I don't want to get into the documentation. I just want to stick with the data. Whenever there's a cycle date and markets are making a new high and there's signs of emotion in the market, it makes sense to bet that the emotion will turn to the other side. You don't know what the news will be. Cycles don't tell you what the news will be. But Jack will tell you that the market is primed for a change in the emotional aspect of the market. So that's why I want to get to cycles. We're near the end, maybe near the end of our conversation, maybe not. But I'm going to show charts of various indices that turned on cycle dates. For example, we show gold peaked on May 4th, 2023. After getting 27.4%, it was a Montgomery cycle date. I'm not going to tell you what cycle dates are. You have to be a subscriber to really know what they are. And it declined 12% in 111 days. Bottomed out in November 13th, 2023 cycle date, and it rallied 10% in 15 days. That's gold. Silver, similar action. The gold mine, similar action. KBW, the bank index, BKX, May 4th, 2023, which was the bear market low on an intraday basis for the banking index, was a Montgomery cycle date. So after a 60% decline, 37% decline in 60 days, but I think it was a 60% decline off its highs. The banking index bottomed in the cycle date, and that basically cycle date basically is hold. It tested that cycle low on October 27, 2023, which too was a Montgomery cycle date. So you had the two major lows in the banking index, both occurred on cycle dates. The SOX index, Philadelphia Semiconductor Index, bottomed September 27, 2023, and it peaked on October 12, 2023, both of them were cycle dates. Then it declined. It made its low on October 31st, 23, which was a cycle date, and it had a historic move since then. Crude oil, skip crude oil, SP 500 also bottomed October 27th, 2023, which was a cycle date as well. So why are we talking about cycle dates? We could skip all these charts. Now, Bitcoin cycle is the best, by the way, but we missed. We thought yesterday's high in Bitcoin might be the final high because it was the final day of the cycle day, but it was up significantly today, so Bitcoin hasn't cycled. But Bitcoin, since it trades strictly on emotions, it doesn't trade any fundamentals at all. And since all cycle dates tell you is when the emotions of a market, the emotions of the participants of the market may shift, Bitcoin has been the greatest asset we have found that trades on cycle dates. It used to be gold and silver. Now it's Bitcoin even more than gold and silver. And basically, as you can see, the May 11th, 2021 peak at 60,000 and change was a cycle date. The October 20th, 2021 peak was a cycle date. And you look at the charts, you can see why are they saying, I'm bringing it back on the cycle dates. Why? Of course, the first cycle date of the current series centered on February 24th, 2024. So with the market, S&P making its high on February 23rd, with the gaps into the high, with the 2.1% gain, which you hadn't seen in over a year, with the FOMO, with what's going on with SMCI, what's going on in NVIDIA, there's a lot of emotion in the market, and it's quite possible that there's a series of cycle dates into May 7th. So this cycle date may not be the one that turns the market, but you don't know whether on March 10th or March 25th you'll see the same type of emotion in the market. The only time cycles work is if the market's at a new high or a low, and there's an emotional aspect to the market. I would point out that on October 11th, 2007, which was the final high of the bull market of 2007, the final date of the high was a Montgomery cycle date. I'd like to point out that the August 25th, 1987, which was the final high before the crash of 1987, was a S&P 500 Montgomery cycle date. I'd like to point out that February 23rd, 2024, which might be proved to be the final high of this bull market that began in 2009 or on a nominal basis, is also a cycle date. So it's a reason to try to pinpoint a peak and start going short as long as the market continues confirming the kind of stuff we are seeing. Let's talk about individual stocks.
Mm-hmm, let's do it.
Very important. Okay, you see number 25, SMCI. Let me tell you our long-only portfolio. Now, any information I give as far as our positions or as far as our return is all theoretical. We have a long-only portfolio, but it's all theoretical. In other words, we recommend buy, we recommend sell, but unlike most analysts, we track all recommendations. When we recommend the buy price, we use average prices rather than a specific price. We use average price over a few hours, sometimes over a day, sometimes over 2 days. And our portfolio is up 18.47% on the year through yesterday's close, through the close of February 27th. Well, one of our largest positions was Supermicrocomputer. We bought it over a year ago. We bought it on technical base. I had no idea they were in AI. I actually had no idea what they do. All I do is make sure it has a good balance sheet before I buy a stock. And that ultimately became over 14% of our portfolio.
Because you didn't rebalance it and it just became so big.
I rebalanced it once during the year, but it took it back down to 5%. But after the first rebalancing, it went up to 14% again. And now it's only 2.5% of the portfolio. We're showing an 858% unrealized gain on the stock. We actually sold the stock in the day of the high for this portfolio. And why do we sell the day of the high? Because you saw the kind of speculation that you see at a market peak. We saw a climax top, and that's number 25. We showed what's the criteria for a climax top. Climax top is really an emotional top. Criteria number one, the stock has to rise. First of all, the stock has to have an extended move. Climax stops don't take place off a low. Climax stocks take place after the stock has already risen quite a while. But first of all, in the climax top, the stock rises 25 to 50% over a 1 to 3 week period. SMCI, Supermicrocomputer, it's called, gained 102% over a 3 week period. Above the 50%, 25 to 50% criteria. Normally at a climax top, the stock is up 7 out of 8 days or 8 out of 10 days. SMCI is up 9 out of 10, 13 out of 14 days into its high. Usually there's one or two exhaustion gaps into a final high. SMCI had its second exhaustion gap into its final high.
Is that when it went over $1,000?
It's the day we sold. They went over $1,000. that the day it went over, no, day went to 1006.35 was the tie. Yeah. The next day went over it again, but next day is the day it crashed. Mm-hmm. Then you have, it breaks, you create a channel of the Atlantic, so it breaks above the channel. In this case, it broke above the channel for 2 days. It's between 70 and 120% above its 200-day moving average. SMCR is 238% above its 200-day moving average. Volume on the climax run has to be the highest, the climax day has to be the highest of the run. Volume on February 16th, 2024 was the highest in history for state of the microcomputer. And the greatest point change of the climax run must take place on that day. And that took place as well. It was the greatest point change. And we got out, and that proved very, very well, because that the market collapsed since then. It's just showing normal action after a climax top. Now, since you're seeing a climax top in SMCI, you're seeing speculative action in NVIDIA and many other AI type stocks. I actually have a list of stocks that were showing crazy action, even things like Abercrombie and Fitch, for example, is an example of stocks that's showing tremendous action. Berkshire Hathaway is showing amazing upside action. I could go through my list. So we shorted 20 stocks for our macro portfolio as a basket. In other words, we're not trying to make money in any one individual stock. We're looking at the basket. Rather than use the NDX, we made our own basket of 20 stocks, which were short. These are basically extended stocks. But I'm amazed at how many extended stocks. When I see stocks that extended, everyone else are claiming bull market, bull market, bull market. Well, bull markets don't see extended stocks. Bull markets sees rational moves in stocks. Commodity tops take place when things look extended. And I don't have to go through the list now, but you know, there's so many stocks that are really not breaking out of bases, but are just extending into up moves with gaps to the upside and so on. That's another reason to think that maybe we're either at a short-term top in the market or maybe a final peak in the S&P. If there's a final peak in the S&P, I believe it will be associated with the recession, because the last peak we saw in 2022, where the Russell went down 30%, NASDAQ went down 30%, S&P went down 25%, was a classic bear market not associated with the recession. There was no recession at all. Some sort of a market slowdown, but if this is the final peak in the bull market on a nominal basis and a secondary peak on a inflation adjusted basis, I think it's finally about time it could be a recession. At this time, it's more likely a recession than the years ago, a year, 2 years ago, when everybody was calling for a recession. Everyone was calling for a recession in October 2022, and the market went higher. No one's calling for a recession now in March, in February of 2023. And the market's probably going to turn lower, and there probably will be a recession or at least a major slowdown. Now, I don't want to go through the fundamentals. I studied the fundamentals. The fundamentals are not yet clear that there'll be a recession. You know why? Fundamentals are never clear that there'll be a recession until after the recession.
Yeah.
Even the National Bureau of Economic Research was called recession. No, it calls it a year and a half later, because they really can't be convinced of a recession. To suggest that you can call a recession before the recession takes place, you know, you get a great job as an economist in some financial bank, because I don't know anyone who's been able to do it. But the way I look at it, there are enough clues that we may have a recession. You know, the leading indicator is down 23 months in a row. You have that inverted yield curve. You have the industrial production, other than technology, has been declining. Auto production, auto parts production. I see many, 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 many signs of a potential recession ahead. I'm not going to call a recession. I'm going to potentially call a market peak. And I think if the market does peak, there'll probably be a recession.
I just want for the audience, your expertise and your art and science, which you have a lot of confidence in, is your thousands and thousands of technical indicators. When you're talking about you're not an economist, and I'd say you have much less confidence in predicting the ability to predict the economy and your ability than you do in what the data is telling you about the market. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, definitely. The fellow who discovered the yield curve signal was amazing. But it's one signal. For the stock market, you have thousands of signals. You know, it's an easier job to call the stock market than to call the economy. You know, the economy is more difficult to call, because there's so many aspects, there's so many people. Everyone in the world is involved in the economy. Not everyone in the world is involved in markets. So the market could show information on the margin that in the economy is more difficult to recognize.
If you think there's a recession, how do you trade that view out? You know, you can go long bonds versus stocks.
Well, I'm not sure I go long bonds because there's a recession. Another thing I want to point out, thanks for reminding me, is one that about inflation. I don't think inflation is a risk. I'm not saying the market's going to go down because inflation will go higher. I think market's going to go down because when inflation will be tamed. Because I think the reason, I don't think you could have runaway inflation when the debt to GDP ratio on is 125-1, and when you look at off the books debt, it's more than 250-1. Back in the 1970s, inflation debt to GDP ratio was lowest in history. It actually made its actual low in 1980. And it was coming off the post-war. In the war, that the GDP ratio was very high, and it kept declining into 19, and then finally bottomed in 1980. So when the governments have the ability to borrow and ability to spend, then you can have inflation. But when you have the debt to GDP ratio at the current level, of course, the Joe Biden and the Republicans as well are trying to spend as much money as they can, but it's going to come a point where they just cannot. And it comes point where its interest rates are going to bite them, and therefore I think you're really not going to have a problem with inflation. The most likely problem you're going to see is deflationary problem by the end of next year. So initially, when you see rates coming down, inflation coming down, the Fed loosening, people are going to say, "Wow, this is bullish." But in fact, it's going to be bearish because it's going to be a turn from inflation to a deflationary forces. I think the market will sense that, and the market will not rally when the Fed lowers rates. The market will actually decline when the Fed lowers rates, because the market will sense that it's not a healthy disinflation, but it's more like a non-healthy disinflation towards deflationary forces. That's the way I see this this situation. From 2021 to 2022, that bear market was did not occur because of a recession at all. I think the next bear market, if it does take place, will be tied to a recession, and you'll see far greater declines than you currently see. And again, I want to point out again that there's not as much speculation now as you saw in 2021 in the low caps, I mean in the SPACs and in the Cathie Wood type stocks. There's far greater speculation in really good companies, in serious companies, and that's probably more fatal than speculation in companies that most institutions don't own.
Really, why is that?
Well, now the speculation in real estate, which are owned by institutions worldwide, the speculation in bonds, or I shouldn't say speculation in bonds, there's a bear market in bonds, which are owned by institutions worldwide, and blue chip stocks, or good quality stocks, which are owned by institutions don't own the Russell 2000. Institutions don't own the small caps. Institutions don't own the junk. They own the quality, and the speculation is taking place in the quality. So I think it's more fatal to the economy and to the markets when it's the kind of stocks that most people own, most institutions own, that are going to have a problem, rather than it's just the stocks at the margin that most institutions wouldn't touch that are having problems. That's what I see it.
So you're in your long-only portfolio, by definition, you're...
Well, long-only portfolio, let me give you some idea of long-only portfolio.
And you have to be 100% long in stock.
I'll tell you what we do, 100% long-only, no leverage. What we do in the long-only portfolio is we buy based on technicals. Now, I created a nine-factor model to choose stocks. I don't only buy stocks with a nine-factor model. Nine-factor model basically is great at buying stocks off a bear market low. It's not great at buying stocks during an extended up move. So what we're doing is combining that with really chart pattern type, breaking out a basis. We look at earnings momentum as a fundamental, as a technical rather fundamental. And earnings gains, people look at it as fundamental, but in order to look at earnings as fundamental, you have to look at valuation. We don't look at valuation at all. We just look at the momentum of the earnings, momentum of the stock, and whether the stock is breaking out of a base or not. We bought them, for example, Standard Microcomputer. We bought when it was breaking out of a base. It was up over 1,000%, and we held on to it. We had no reason to sell. Many of the stocks we own, Adobe we own. I can tell you the stocks we've recommended in the last 2 months, Constellation Energy, which had a huge move yesterday. I think it was up 14% yesterday. I don't know why. I just know we bought it.
And Constellation Energy or Constellation Brands? Or
yeah, Constellation Energy, CEG.
Okay.
There's a new issue a few years ago. I happen to like the fundamentals of the company, but I bought it based on the technicals. We have a good position in Builders First Source, which also bought on a breakout. It's one of our leading stocks. I own Berkshire both on a technical basis, and I believe it's a method of – I can't put money into cash. Berkshire Hathaway is my when I want to raise cash in the portfolio, I put it to Berkshire Hathaway, and that's my source of funds when I find a stock to buy, because I trust Warren Buffett and his team not to speculate and to keep have enough cash on hand. I think they have the highest cash they've had in history. So yeah. In a sense, I'm putting money into cash, yet their operations and that stock's also been doing very well.
And so that's a long only, but when you're in your long short portfolio or your macro portfolio, which stocks are you short? And also, I should say, Milton, when you're short, you're short Nvidia, Supermicro,
I'm short only extended stocks on the assumption that the next decline will take the extended stocks down more than will take the non-extended stocks. So, example of stocks we're short is Affirm Holdings is one stock. I think it's a pretty low cap stock. We're short ServiceNow. We're short Palo Alto Networks. We're short Spotify Technologies. We're short Uber. We're short Zscaler. A short portfolio, the 20 stocks is down. We're losing 2.15% on the portfolio. At one point, we're up 4%. But this is fine. It's only 20%. It's 1% position in 20 stocks. So it's a 20% of a portfolio. We can go up to 200% short. Mostly we're short indices. We don't generally short a basket of stocks. But we generally would not – this portfolio doesn't take a long positions in individual stocks or short positions. We only short a basket based on a theme. This theme was basically overextended stocks that should decline greater than the market if the market does decline. It's really a bet on the market, not a bet on these individual stocks. So that's a story. So is NVIDIA one of our names? Yeah, NVIDIA is one of the names. Netflix is one of the names.
And do you have a stop loss? Like, what if NVIDIA goes from $800 to $1,500? Do you have a stop loss? Or
the stop loss will be on the basket, not on individual stock.
Got it.
Like, if somebody owns the S&P 100, you ask him, what happens if Apple goes down 50%? Will you sell the S&P? Will you sell Apple? No, I own the index, right? So this is my index of stocks to short. So if I decide that the market's going to rally, I will sell the index. Now, you're asking a good question. You realize the position is only 1%. And so if NVIDIA doubles, I'll be losing 1% of my portfolio.
You know, I also want to say, when people are listening to interviews with, you know, high-level investors, I think of like Stan Druckenmiller. You know, Stan Druckenmiller in 2022 said, oh, I'm pretty bearish. I think there's going to be a huge recession. And then his 13D or 13F file comes out and he owns NVIDIA and Eli Lilly. So, you know, but that's because he was being honest when he said he shared his bearish views. It's just he changed his mind. Likewise, you could see something in the market that turns you extremely bullish over the next 2 weeks. And I don't want someone, you know, listening to this and saying, oh, I shorted NVIDIA because Milton Berg said so. That's
Don't short NVIDIA. We only short as a basket. We're short as a basket. No, it's part of a basket. But I want you to point out something very interesting. I should have mentioned it earlier. It's one of the points I wanted to make. There are no shorts in NVIDIA. There are no shorts in Standard Micro. All shorts have covered. You don't have. I don't want to mention the name. There's a very famous short seller who's always bragging about he's short Tesla and he's short Netflix. They got killed. You know, one of the guys you always see in the interviews. I don't know if you have interviewed this fellow. But he's not pounding the table to short NVIDIA, to short Supermicrocomputer. You understand? So these stocks don't have shorts in them, which means it makes sense to go short these kind of stocks now. Now, you know, earlier, a year ago, maybe we were shorting these stocks, but currently nobody's shorting these stocks. You don't see short interest in these stocks. So another reason to think that the market's vulnerable. It's when you can't. You know, that's why they're making a mistake in China. China doesn't want people to short stocks. If you short stocks, you have natural buyers that come in if the market declines. If you don't short a stock, there's no natural buyers. So the Chinese got it backwards, which is typical for communist countries to get things backwards. But they got it totally backwards. They should encourage short positions. And then when the economy does, because a short position won't affect the economy. The short position, take a stock down. When the economy does well, you will be forced to cover. And you see the type of action we saw in NVIDIA and in Supermicro and, you know, with other stocks. So, they're making a big mistake.
Sorry to interrupt. Just want to tell you about Blockworks' upcoming crypto symposium in London, the Digital Asset Summit, which is running from March 18th to March 20th. Everyone in crypto is going to be there, not just the experts and policymakers, but the real industry leaders writing the checks. Over $800 billion in assets is going to be represented. Anyone who's anyone in crypto is going to be there. So if you're into crypto and you haven't bought your ticket yet, the time is now to get your ticket. I would not wait any longer. We've got some exciting guests on the macro side too. Julian Brigden, Michael Howell. And yes, I can confirm at last, the rumors are true. Joseph Wang, the Fed guy himself, is going to be there too. I'll be hosting a panel with these macro heavyweights that you don't want to miss. So be there or be square. Click the link in the description and use code FG10 to get 10% off. Thanks. Let's get back to the interview. So Milton, as we approach the close, can you share your views on the market? And specifically, what gives you confidence that this is going to be a corrective move in a bull market versus the start of a new bear market?
I could see it either way. I think the reason I'm willing to say it might be the start of a bear market is, A, we're at a new all-time high in the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ. So bear markets begin from all-time highs. The technical indicators that you generally see at an all-time high are in line with the top. The sentiment is at a top. Federal policy is at the top. Interest rates are kind of information you see at the top. There's a potential recession ahead, which nobody recognizes, which the fact that nobody recognizes is something you often see at the top. And you have excess speculation in good companies, which is something you don't always see at the top. Sometimes you see excess speculation in weak companies. But seeing excess speculation in good companies is more likely to be a serious top, like you saw at the top of 1973, or in 1929, when the exit speculation did not occur in small cap stocks, actually occurred in high quality companies. That's why I think it might be a bear market peak. And on top of all that is the cycle date, which most people aren't interested in, but I have clients at Titans of Wall Street arranged in our cycle dates. And there's a cycle period began on February 24th. It ends on May 7th. It's likely that one major market will top during this period. It's highly unlikely a major market will bottom because no markets are bottoming. So we think based on the current cycle date, which was February 24th, we think the February 23rd high in the CAC, high in the Nikkei, high in the NASDAQ, high in the S&P 500, maybe a final top, especially if the gaps into the high, especially the worldwide people talking about breakouts and higher action. We're willing to take a bet on the short. Now, normally you can go up to 200% short, but we're waiting for more confirmation. Why are we waiting for more confirmation? Because in the back of my head, I do know that we had buy signals in October, November, December. We've met the minimum objectives, but we haven't met the medium objectives. The minimum objectives were roughly 5,000 in the S&P, which we reached. The medium objectives are 5,500 to 5,600 to 50, as high as 5,650. So if we're wrong about being short here, the market will go significantly higher in the next 12 months to 5,500 or so. But, you know, right now we're really – right now our stance is to be out of the market, to be negative, and to institute short exposure. Now, we have a long-only portfolio, long-only recommendations, which is really doing quite well. I'm nervous that some of these stocks will do poorly in a bear market, so I'm trying to get out of the stocks that have done well, stocks look overextended, and trying to get into stocks that have already declined. Maybe they will decline less if there is a bear market, although they're strong companies. For example, one of the companies we just recommended was PayPal. PayPal had a lot of competition, but it still has a great balance sheet, it's a great franchise, and it's showing earnings, and it's down. Another one is Alibaba, which is a company that still shows earnings. It's been harassed by the Chinese government. The stock's down, but it's part of a market that's down 60%. So we think that's something to be a protection for us. Our greatest protection, we believe, is Berkshire Hathaway, where we raise cash. But we can't have more than, you know, we have 6% of our portfolio in Berkshire. We can't have much more than that. But we consider that a source of funds. So we think Berkshire Hathaway is a great place to be in case there's a bear market. But I would like to say, again, all this is theoretical, all this is speculative, all this is based on technical analysis and based on our view at the moment. Our view could change at any time. And it probably will change sometime, but it could change at any time. And I really appreciate the interview, Jack. And I enjoyed it. I think we covered a lot of bases here, which is really, really good.
We did. Milton, so just how many buy signals do you have and how many sell signals do you have right now, roughly?
Buy signals, we had 30 in November, about 30 in December. We had quite a number of buy signals. Again, they've met the minimum objective. The buy signals we had last January, which projected 4,800 to 5,000 in the S&P, turned out to work out.
And so they worked out, but they're stale now.
They're stale. Those are totally stale. The new signals, you know, they didn't come off a bear market low, so they have less of an effect. And we're bothered by market action. You know, then now sell signals work differently. We don't get sell signals the same way we get buy signals. The stock market generally bottom on a spike bottom, but markets generally top on a rounding, you know, mountaintop type of a top. So, you know, you're seeing that kind of information. You're seeing the Russell peaking in December. You're seeing various reasons to believe we're at a top. But sell signals, we don't call them sell signals at top. We call them indications of a potential top. And we have many indications of potential top. We need the market to confirm. I can assure you if the market in the next week or so has a down 1% day on a downside gap, that will be a confirmation that the February 23rd gap side to the upside was a final high. We don't have that yet. We like the action in the individual stocks off their highs that they made in late February. But the market itself, it's holding its February 23rd high, but it hasn't showed at this point, it hasn't showed its true color. We'd like to see further decline before we increase our short exposure. We're only 30% short, and we can get as much as 200% short at the right time. Again, it's a trading point. I want to point out these great investors you mentioned in this point earlier, we mentioned the names, are all traders. As far as I know, other than Warren Buffett's an investor. He's a great investor. He's a great investor, but he's an investor. He's not a trader. But most of the famous hedge fund operators who've made a lot of money for themselves and for their clients over the years, be it a Michael Steinhardt or be it people you mentioned, they're generally traders. They get in, they get out. They follow the data. They don't say, I'm going to buy the stock and hold it forever. Retail accounts generally get caught up in the idea of investing. Now, as they say, if you invest at average prices, you'll make the average return of 10% in the S&P 500 if it continues acting as it did in the past. But if you buy at a peak, you're not going to make 10% over the long term. If you buy now, there are some astute investors, they're perma bears, but they're great analysts who suggest the S&P will down 60% over the next till the next low. If you buy now, as much as you think you'll make 10% over the next 20 years, you probably won't if you're first down 60% in the next 2 or 3 years. So caveat mTOR, it's a nice game, the stock market. I put a lot of work into it. And I do, you know, we have our clients and most of them are happy with what we do. We do the best we can. And I really appreciate Jack. These interviews are always very, very good for me, for it gets me to think, and you ask the right questions, and we cover a lot of ground. And it's not superficial. It's in depth, which is very, very helpful to myself and helpful to the people who see this interview. Thank you.
How big do you think the decline could be?
I'm not going to discount, as I said earlier in the interview, these people looking for 60% decline from the next peak, they could be right this time because now the things are in line for a bull market peak. I'm not projecting that. I'd be happy with a 15% decline if I could catch the bottom. I'd be happy with an 8% decline if I could catch the bottom. But I think the market is now set up for a major bear market. I think the bull market peak on an inflation-adjusted basis occurred in 2021, 2022. We had a long, long series of new highs on an inflation-adjusted basis from 2009 to 2022. I think we're headed with a longer-term inflation-adjusted bear market. How far down it goes, it's hard to say. You know, with the government debt to GDP ratio, the government at crazy levels, with the stock market valuation at historic highs, I can't discount these perma bears who are looking for a 60% decline. I wouldn't call for it. I'd be again happy with 8% or 15% or 19% typical bear market decline. I'd be happy with that.
You know, needless to say, you are not a perma bear and you've been bullish for, you know, most of the move. So if someone is a perma bear, even if they're right this time, it's kind of like, okay, you know, finally you cried wolf, finally the wolf appeared. But yeah, you are not a perma bear. I just want to say, you know, people can find your work on Twitter at Berg Milton. You only publish a fraction of your work.
I publish a fraction of my work and I publish it late.
Yeah, yeah. The clients get your work at miltonberg.com and you've got an institutional client base.
Miltonberg.com and you can, yeah, if anyone wants to be a client. Unfortunately, I say we don't take retail clients unless they're family offices.
Yep, and there is a book coming out, Milton's Berg Guide to Technical Analysis.
Book coming out, which, you know, I've been so busy working on the market, I haven't had time to work on the book, but everything we talk about in the market should be involved in the book as well. So really, it's an active process. Hopefully, we'll get it out within a year, hopefully.
Hopefully, we'll see. Thank you, Milton, and thank you for everyone for watching.
Thank you.
Thanks for watching. Remember to check out vaneck.com/hodlfg. To learn more about the VanEck Bitcoin Trust, ticker HODL. A reminder that forward guidance episodes are available on all podcast apps and on Twitter, where I post them regularly at JackFarley96. Thanks again. Until next time.